Hello everyone, welcome back to Morgan Hasn't Seen. We're 30 years in the future from where we were last week. It's the same world, but it really, really doesn't look like the same world. For, yes, in story reasons, but also, I think, from filmmaking reasons and what we have in today's big spectacle visual blockbusters as opposed to those from 40 years ago. I think our visual styles in mainstream big movies have changed quite significantly. And I think this and its predecessor that we spoke about last week are perfect examples of that change. For me, at least, I feel like that is the case. But we're back this week with the final of our cyborg sci-fi series here on Morgan Hasn't Seen. We do have one episode left on the main show, of course, this Friday, where we'll be talking about the Stepford Wives and getting into all the different craziness, book Stepford Wives, the 1975 movie and the 2004 version as well. That will be an exciting episode, so stay tuned in to It's a Wonderful Podcast for that, of course. But yes, 30 years on from Blade Runner, from the story of Blade Runner, we have Blade Runner 2049, which was in 2017, it came out, and in reading some stuff and remembering some stuff that I was hearing around that time, it was a bit of a risk, a bit of a daunting job for those involved to do, but it was really championed by Harrison Ford, who really liked the story of it, really enjoyed the script of it. And I don't think Denis Villeneuve really wanted to do this movie out of respect for Blade Runner until Harrison Ford
was on board.
No, come on, we're doing this. This is good, right? Is it good? It's very, very interesting. I think it's a pretty good movie. I really do think it's
a great story as well.
It is a fantastic story and really almost the perfect way of continuing the story and coming back into the world of Blade Runner. You can't really, I mean, to do it in this way, to bring almost more depth to the world, the ideas that are going on. It's a ridiculously existential movie. And I know Blade Runner itself was last week we talked about it. And what I really loved about Blade Runner was that fundamentally it was just about enjoying life and not taking life for granted, because the replicants don't take life for granted.
Yeah.
They realize that they've only got a finite amount of time. Don't we all have a finite amount of time? Yes, but they seem far more tuned into that fact and want to do the most with the time they have. And yes, okay, cause uprisings because they don't like being put down and thought of as second class and being sent to these slave colonies and all these kind of things. But what we have, I think, in this movie is almost an exploration of loneliness, which makes Blade Runner 2049, to me, quite a sad movie. And I think reasonably, therefore, it moves at this really quite methodical pace
that
kind of wallows you into everything, does make you feel quite down and miserable a lot of the time.
Isolated. Yeah, our characters, the world, the difference in the world from the first film, definitely just feels very like a lonely, isolated place.
Yeah. And that really struck me because I loved so much about the visuals of Blade Runner, the messiness of everything, the grittiness of everything, the dirt everywhere, the trash
everywhere.
The hustle,
the bustle,
And the people everywhere. Exactly. They're just, it just seemed to be such a lived-in LA of 2019, even though it's unrecognizable to real LA of 2019. But LA of 2049 is just desolate. I mean, I know it explains it that at some point the ecosystems failed and there was a big blackout event, and basically we're living in a totally changed world, even from the first Blade Runner, in terms of life and what the world acts like. But my God, is that represented visually really strikingly differently, or really strikingly, because maybe this is a Denis Villeneuve thing as well, because, okay, I might not be the biggest fan of his appearance to be rather pompous and up himself, as I would like to say, when it comes to certain things. Or maybe this isn't necessarily against him, but against those who have formed a certain cult around him, which I believe to have happened. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility to have actually happened, given what we see on the internets and things regarding Mr. Villeneuve. But I'm not sure I really love this sort of minimalist, big spectacle style. I prefer a spectacle to have things going on in it. And there's just, there seems like there's 10 people living in LA of 2049. Okay. And that is the case. It works for the story. I'm not saying it doesn't work for the story. It's exactly what the story needs it to represent. It's perfect for that.
Yes, but just the juxtaposition of seeing this world in the last film and then going into this one, it just feels like a drastic shift.
It's a personal preference from me.
Yeah.
I prefer kind of things happening. A lot of things happening.
Yes. And I mean, I think that probably plays into his recent comments about visuals being more important than dialogue. And so that kind of, maybe you see that once hearing that that's kind of his stance on filmmaking and that's kind of where he wants to go and that's something he wants to see, I think that makes it kind of more obvious why certain decisions were made in this film, why it's quieter and more isolated and, you know, really just focusing on how things look as opposed to, you know, how many people are present and how busy the world is.
Which you can't fault. It's a filmmaker's choice. It's a filmmaker's style. And that is his style. He's pretty consistent in that style, you have to say. So you can't fault that. I have nothing against that. It is literally, I think, a personal preference from me. But I would argue that point with, isn't Ridley Scott also a man that is visual over everything else in his movies? I think he is, yet he has more there. And as much as I like to be visual above a lot of other things as well, I just think perhaps my preference of visuals is a little bit different. And that doesn't mean to say I don't like slow movies and big, grand visual spectacles. Of course I do. Of course I do. And I didn't find myself not liking Blade Runner 2049 because of this. Perhaps there's a certain seeping in of my distaste towards the Villeneuve crowd that was present, was living in the back of my mind while watching this. But does it stop me really, really enjoying what I saw from this movie, really getting into the ideas behind it, the phenomenal development of the idea of replicants that have now developed into, I think, an eighth generation of Nexus.
I believe our Ryan Gosling K character is a Nexus 9 replicant.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, we are significantly developed on the replicant front as well. But we're dealing with our lead Blade Runner character in Ryan Gosling K, who is openly a replicant. He's aware he's a replicant. There's no theories around this Blade Runner being a replicant or not. He definitely is. And he is, you know, discriminated against for it pretty heavily in the movie. But it's just really interesting to sit in the entire, you know, 2.75-hour movie with him virtually in every single scene of the movie.
Yeah.
We are really living with him, with his thoughts, with his mind, with his emotional capacity. There's plenty of that there. There's certainly a development in replicants' emotional state from Blade Runner, even though it's very, very present in Blade Runner as well. But there's a love aspect that's pretty well taken care of in this movie, pretty well dealt with. There's just more to the, I think, world and maybe the rather nasty, somewhat corrupt nature of this world that I feel like Blade Runner itself maybe got into some areas of. But this, I mean, I suppose this is another reason why I felt 2049 was just quite a sad movie, or a very pessimistic movie.
Okay.
Because I think at least there's some degree of optimism. Yes, it's a dystopian world in a way.
Yes.
In Blade Runner. And yes, it is an unrecognizable world from what existed in the real world in 2019.
Yes, but it does have this beautiful message. Hope. Yeah.
Yeah. And there just isn't in 2049 at all. Like, throughout the entire thing, it just seems very uncomfortable
down,
and very
dire,
pessimistic.
Yeah. Yes.
Which, you know, makes it, I'm going to say, not enjoyable to watch, but I don't mean it in that sense. I mean, it's very worthwhile watching. It's just not really that fun. And it doesn't have to be fun. It's not trying to be fun. It's trying to be thought-provoking, and it works as that perfectly.
But I think, you know, again, it's just the juxtaposition. You're seeing this world set up for you, and despite kind of being this dystopian, dark, gritty kind of place where things aren't perfect and, you know, it's not this, like, happy utopia, but you still have this really kind of beautiful through line message of not taking life for granted and really seeing characters who aren't human valuing life more than humans do. And it makes you think and be hopeful about, you know, how you view life. So despite the world being kind of as dark as it is, there's still a hopeful message in there. And then you come to this movie that doesn't really have that. So I think that's probably where your kind of mind is maybe sitting.
Well, yeah, but I do still think that replicants value life more than humans do in this movie.
Yes, but that message is not the focus of this movie, really.
No, it's not. Yeah. No, it's not. Before we get into much more of today's discussion on Blade Runner 2049, we do have to say a big thank you to our It's a Wonderful Podcast patrons, of course. We love them dearly. They are wonderful, wonderful people. If you would like to join them and join us on the Patreon and support us in that way, or support us with just donating in that sense as well, there are links in the description of this episode to go and do that. We would certainly love you forever, much like we love and want to say thank you, Janine, to Adam Witt.
And thank you, Michael Smith.
Thank you to Abby Friel.
Thank you, Ferris Muthana.
Thank you, Janine's big brother, Justin, 90s Comics Box.
Thank you, Tina Farrow.
Thank you to Marcus Burton.
Thank you to Movie Fanobi Steve.
Thank you to Sir Mia Tesfai.
Thank you, Patrick Harden.
Thank you to Carla Feese.
Thank you to the great Ken Knapsack.
Thank you to Tom and Kimber of the Odd Shape Channel.
Thank you, Eric Garcia.
And thank you to Billy Polahan.
Yes.
I mean, did you see 2049 when it came out?
I did not. No. I think I watched it for the first time a few years ago. So maybe like a year or two after it came out. So I didn't really remember a whole lot about it. So this was kind of a fresh watch for me as well going into this. I didn't really remember the story or how it kind of continued the story from the first film. So
do you find yourself enjoying it? Because I know we spoke about last week how Blade Runner, obviously, we know this from the 250th special that Morgan hasn't seen when we went through our bucket list, is that Blade Runner itself has always been that one movie for me that more people than anything else have told me I have to watch. I therefore, in my own stubbornness, never did watch, but was always sure that I would enjoy it when I got round to it.
Yeah.
And found myself last week really loving the movie. Like really, really loving the movie. Just as much as I thought I would.
Yeah.
And maybe more so, because I found it just so interesting, but ultimately also pretty straightforward when you actually think about it. Yes, very thought-provoking, but something that wants that, it wants its audience, I think, to be able to think about the things that are going on in it, to have the, it gives the audience almost the intelligence to think about those things, which I think is a great thing about it, because it's not necessarily expecting a certain height, you know, heightiness, haughtiness, I suppose, from the audience. Anyway, maybe Blade Runner 2049 is expecting this certain, I don't know, existential haughtiness from its own audience to be able to explore what it does, because it's exploring similar things, but just in a little bit more of a deeper way that does invite more deeper thought, but also I think might push people away just because it's a little bit too much. You know, I don't feel like it's too much.
No, I mean,
it feels like maybe. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I really liked this story. I thought it was a good continuation of where we left off. It does something that movies do in a really smart way. I think a lot of movies, when they become franchises, they maybe lazily try to retroactively add something to the lore that wasn't there before. Think of something like the Terminator films. You know, they add this element of, you know, the skin is made of like genetic human skin, so it ages or whatever, so that, you know, they can have an excuse for things in their story. But this film adds a really interesting element to the replicants that kind of creates what our plot is.
Yeah.
And so our whole plot kind of is predicated on this addition to what we thought we knew. So I think it's a really smart way of adding something to something we thought we knew and kind of building your story around that. So I just really loved this story.
Yeah, the story is definitely the strongest part of the movie for me. And that seems strange when it looks the way it does. And yes, okay, it does look, it's very striking. It does feel like you could put most frames of the movie on an enormous landscape on your wall. That's just the nature of how it shook. It would be quite a humanless landscape. There would be nothing going on in it, but it would look very pretty. And that's important as well. But the addition that you speak of, what I think is so clever about it is the fact that it's not necessarily not there in the first movie. You just don't know.
You just don't know.
Sure or not.
Yes. So I like that it expands on something that wasn't inherently clear. So they could easily kind of just slide it in there and make it a part of the story that makes sense. Because like I said, you know, you can think of other movies that do something similar, but do it in a really lazy kind of way. Or they do it and it doesn't really mean anything to the story as a whole. It also feels like a story element that it was very similar to another movie that we covered in this series. Which also, you know, this movie does give me the feeling of like something you would see in an anime story, because the plot point that we kind of are looming around saying is the fact that replicants, it is discovered that replicants can procreate and get pregnant, which was a plot point in the anime film we started this series with, Armitage 3, that those advanced robots were able to get pregnant and have children. And so that made them a threat to humankind. So that is kind of discovered through familiar characters that we knew from the first film. We know that Deckard and Rachel ran off together. And, you know, then Kay does end up finding the bones of Rachel. And they learn that those bones of her body were in fact pregnant. So there is a replicant child out there. And so Kay is tasked to finding this child and destroying it, because this could start a huge war between replicants and humans. And so to prevent that, he is tasked to kind of just handle it very quietly. And so part of that is him trying to find Deckard, who's been kind of in hiding all of this time.
And that's the grand purpose of the movie. It's a very good mystery in that sense, almost, or at least a very good investigation of a movie, because, you know, it really does emphasize the significance of if this secret gets out. And this secret is something that certain people in this movie have known for a while and have just not divulged to anybody. Really don't want this secret getting out. Really don't want a war. Really don't want humankind to be made aware that replicants can procreate and therefore potentially pose a threat. Now, whether that would happen, we don't know. It might just, many species can procreate, you know, in fact all of them. So
yes,
we don't have wars against chimpanzees, do we? But you know, this is a threat to humankind.
But then we also are getting it from two ends. We have the side that wants to prevent war and doesn't want this information out there. But then there's also the corporatization of it all with the company that took over the Tyrell Corporation, who makes their own replicants. They want to figure out this technology. They want to figure out how to make their replicants procreate. So they they're after trying to find Deckard so that they can get information on where this child is, so that they can cut it apart and study it and figure out how it was created.
Yeah, you know, all these movies we've spoke about through this cyborg sci-fi series, you know, Jared Leto hasn't watched any of them, because if he had, he would have learnt to not try and play God with robots.
Yes.
And create them in your own image, create them for your own purposes, and try and create life. Stop trying to do it. Wonderful casting to cast Jared Leto as this incredibly full of himself person, by the way.
Yes.
who is just detestable in every sense. God.
Yes.
I am a god. I'm swanning around like some sort of genius. No, Mr. Terrell in Blade Runner, he came across as a genuine genius. Yes, full of himself, but not annoyingly so, and clearly quite clever. You just act like you're prancing around in a big robe thing.
Yes, and he's very
just
fancy.
Just because you also happen to be blind, I don't know why that's relevant, but
yes,
it's just an added little twist to the character. I don't
know. That he can create these beautiful things despite being blind, so he's just even more incredible.
Why do I have this cynical attitude towards, I'm going to call it, the modern day spectacle blockbuster? Why does he need to be blind? It's okay, there's a reason he does, because it is this interesting idea of he can't see any of the wonders that he creates.
But he can still create. Yes, but he still can create these wondrous things.
But it for some reason, me and my horrible mind, it comes across as just, oh God, it happens in every single one of these stupid movies you get today. Just, why does it need to be that way? We understand the fundamental of the character. It doesn't have to be this extra version of it.
Yeah, this extra
everything
to make it a cooler, you know, deeper, you know, in more intense character or whatever.
Why does everything have to have an extra element to it? Why can't we just stick with the fundamentals that work? If they're dealt with properly, they work.
Yes. Yes, it was definitely a choice to kind of add this creative flair to this character, I think. But even just looking at the cast, like, we're really working with a very limited cast of kind of surprise faces that just pop up in here. Like,
yeah,
you know,
like I said, there's 10 people living in LA of 2049. There's not many people here at all. Because we're spending every scene of the movie near enough with Ryan Gosling. And I mean, Ryan Gosling's great, obviously. We like Ryan Gosling. We love Ryan Gosling,
yes,
obviously. But he is doing precious little with his face in this movie, because he's not supposed to be. He's a very stoic performance in this movie. A very almost emotionless performance, unless he really needs to be, unless he really calls for it.
Yes,
and he's able
really
to do that little thing with his eyebrows that he does, where he just kind of shoves them in a little bit and looks really, really sad.
Yes, I mean, he's really able to put across that he is a replicant, but he does feel things without, and he can do that without doing very much with his face, because he has this emotional connection to this kind of holographic girlfriend he has, played by Ana de Armas. Because, yes, like I said, literally maybe like 10 people in this movie that we follow, all of them kind of like big known names. So we have Ana de Armas in this film as Joy, his kind of holographic girlfriend. And he really has this strong emotional connection to her. And they kind of are just pretending to play house together. Despite him not really even being human himself, you can tell that he is very strongly connected to her, because even in the, you know, things get very hairy and she asks him to erase her so that they can't kind of track what he's doing, because at a certain point he does kind of have to go rogue, and he refuses to destroy her because he cares about her so much. So it's this weird kind of relationship that you really get invested in, despite both of these characters not being real like human people. So, you know, him being able to put that across and convey that, both of them, I think just is a testament to their performances. They're doing very little and so much at the same time, because they are playing these characters who are meant to feel things despite not being human. So it's a really interesting line to try to figure out, but I think they do a beautiful job investing us in that relationship.
Absolutely, they do. And I don't think that's an easy thing to do, because, yes, okay, they're both human actors, obviously, and the AI love story is always tends to be quite interesting, because it does bring up these ideas of, oh God, is this really where humanity's going to go? This is really quite sad. Like,
yeah.
AI love stories are always very, very bittersweet because on the surface, they're so nice. They're so, you know, full. The heart in them is so full. It feels so pleasant. Yet right under the first layer, we're constantly reminded of, yeah, this person you're in love with isn't actually real.
Isn't a real thing. But, machine. You know, and yes.
This happens virtually in everyone. The and again, this is an example of 2049 doing something extra,
yeah.
Is the fact that in this version of the AI love story, they're both forms of AI, technically.
Yes.
It's and just one of them's more developed than the other
than
one.
Than the other one, yes. And we get this sobering reminder, this really sad sobering reminder of kind of the illusion of this relationship because kind of near the end, yes, near the end of the film, Joy is in fact destroyed. And then it's the kind of iconic scene that you, that still that you always see when this movie is talked about.
Yeah,
of this
big
kind
pink
of,
Ana de Armas.
Yes, like pointing at like small little Ryan Gosling on a bridge or whatever. And when this image does come about, it's an advertisement for this virtual woman that you can buy and take home and make her whatever you want it to be. And that is Joy. So
yeah,
then
what
you
a horrible thought as well.
And
let's
he
buy
sees
a virtual
this,
woman.
Right? And he sees this advertisement pointing at him, talking to him, advertising to him right after he's lost his Joy. So we get all wrapped up in this relationship. We are actually genuinely heartbroken when she, her image, her memory is destroyed. And then we learn that she is just this kind of sex avatar kind of toy that people can buy to have this fun simulation for themselves. And that's all she really was.
It is not a pleasant thought to think
no.
that your relationship is so easily replaceable.
Yes. And so the fact that he's seeing this right after he loses her is just kind of tragic and just plays into, I think, the sadness that you were talking about this film really conveying.
It is. It's a massive tragedy. And it works really, really well as a massive, massive tragedy. Full of mystery, like I said, but full of a sense of untrustworthiness as well. You can't really trust anything that's going on. Can Kay even trust himself? Does Kay even really know who he is properly?
Yes, because at a certain part in this mystery, he finds the DNA of this replicant child, but one is male, one is female. And they both have the same exact DNA. So somebody kind of messed with the system in order to help hide this child. So at a certain point, he thinks that he may be that replicant child of Rachel and Deckard. So did I
at one point as well.
Yes. So it does have us questioning that for a good portion of the film. And he even, you know, very much like Deckard when he sees the unicorn, it's kind of very unspoken on Deckard really kind of feeling like whether he is or not. It's not something that is talked about in the film, but they give you enough clues that we are questioning that.
At least in the final cut, of course.
In the official final cut. But in this version, we actually do see Kay questioning whether he maybe really is a replicant or not, because he does have this implanted memory of him being a child in this orphanage, and he has this toy horse and all the kids are teasing him and they take his horse and he gets it back and then he hides it because that was his little precious toy. That's all he had, to the point where once he starts feeling like he could be this replicant child, he goes to somebody who is known to be like this great memory maker who builds the memories that get put into replicants.
And this is a little bit terrifying.
She's isolated in this big bubble because she has like autoimmune issues. And so if she leaves this bubble, she could get sick and die. So in this bubble, you know, she creates these memories. And we see her in the middle of just creating them out of nothing, and they feel so real. So she's pretty good at being able to read whether a memory is real or fake. So he's able to show her his one memory. And because he wants to know if it was implanted or if this was something he really remembered. And, you know, she watches this memory of him hiding his toy horse, getting bullied by these kids. And she tears up and she tells him, yeah, no, this is not a made up memory. This is, in fact, a real memory. So now we're just like, now what's going on? What is he real? Is he not? Like, so it raises more questions for us, which I think it really kind of amps up where the plot ends up going.
It does. It's another very ambiguous Blade Runner movie that we're not quite sure what's going on with, you know, the characters in themselves. You know, it seems to me after this really quite heavily emotional scene that, yes, Kay is a child of replicants.
Yeah.
But still at this point, we might think he's Deckard's and Rachel's child.
Yes. Yeah.
So maybe after we learn that, no, okay, that's not really the case, I think we can still probably see that he is, at least according to the Grand Memory Maker, a child of replicants. But can she be fully trusted? Yes, okay, she's probably the foremost source on whether or not the memory is real.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's just one person's opinion. And I think that's what's interesting as well, is you get kind of people's opinions on things rather than concrete answers, which I think Blade Runner itself did really, really well as well. But this movie definitely does do very, very well. And does very much feel akin to Blade Runner in the sense that you are completely left wondering really who the hell everybody really is.
Well, yeah,
but you don't mind not knowing. You don't mind that the movie doesn't directly answer anything because you don't want it to. It kind of means it doesn't.
Yes, it gives you everything you need. And then, like, we open this film almost where Blade Runner ended, I think, with Dave Bautista's character. He is a replicant that Kay is sent to, you know, retire.
And his funny little glasses.
Yes, and he, like, lives on this farm. And this is where he ends up finding the bones of Rachel buried. And he kind of has this poignant speech, just like, you know, Roy Batty had at the end of the film, that also kind of has this hopeful beat. He's talking about, you know, he is fine being retired in this moment because he has witnessed a miracle. And we don't know what that means at this point. So he has this hopeful outlook for a future because he was able to witness this miracle that we don't know until later. We learn that the miracle is that he was able to witness, you know, this a replicant being able to have a child.
Replicant childbirth.
Yes.
He was there. He was watching it. He was through his little glasses. Intently.
Yes.
Tiniest glasses you've ever seen on the largest
man ever. Yes. But again, like, just literally 10 people in this movie and all of them are like names that, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
But
he's barely in the movie. I mean, I was aware that Dave Bautista was in this movie and of his little glasses because I remember it being a big thing.
Yeah.
But he's literally in like the first scene of the movie and then again because he gets retired by Kay.
But he does give us this hopeful setup for kind of where the story ends up going. And
The one semblance of hope in the entire movie,
pretty much. And I like that juxtaposition of the final scene of Roy Batty giving this speech about life and how beautiful it is and how fleeting it can be. You know, this very poetic kind of eulogy that he gives himself almost, and then you go into this character giving his own kind of fateful eulogy about, you know, I can end this life now because I was able to witness something great. So
it's a very interesting thing you bring up there, actually, because I suppose Dave Bautista's in this movie, well, obviously is very similar, but does end in that kind of positive way. Like, yeah. I'm happy to die because of what I've witnessed. And yeah. Roy Batty's very much, oh, I'm about to die. Well, none of it really matters. I wish it did matter. That's really miserable. It's really miserable at the end of actual Blade Runner.
Yeah.
And really hopeful at the beginning of this. A very good, you know, yin and yang of two things there.
Yes.
Interesting. I hadn't necessarily picked up on that. I like that you brought that up.
Yes. I mean, I don't know if it was a purposeful thing to kind of juxtapose the ending to this beginning in a significant way, with both of these replicants kind of eulogizing their own deaths. But, you know, that was something I kind of noticed and thought was really interesting to kind of kick off where our story goes. Just to kind of get into more characters in the film, we have Robin Wright. She's Kay's boss, who
good hairstyle.
Yes, who he reports to. She gives him all his orders of what he's supposed to do. So once they do find these bones, she is the one who tasks him to destroy it in order to prevent this war that would come about if more people knew about this. We obviously talked about Jared Leto.
I don't like Robin Wright's great, obviously, but the whole situation surrounding Kay's employment as a Blade Runner. It seems a rather fleeting employment, doesn't it? Like, if you turn up to work and you don't pass your psychology test that you have,
whatever
it's actually called, you basically just get killed and bye. You're dead now. You don't exist.
You don't pass this verbal test.
Why does it have to be like you die if you don't pass this psychology test?
I don't know if it's so extreme. I don't know if it's like this extreme version of the Voight-Kampff test where, you know, that was meant to reveal who replicants were. Maybe this test is meant to kind of reveal a flaw or something that could potentially have you kind of go off of your protocol or whatever. Maybe I don't know if it's really explained who
with any power are you going to tell anything to? You're working for the people with the power.
Yes, and there's only 10 other people in this world. So.
Yeah, there's nobody else there.
Yes.
There's no other scenes of, you know, like we had in Blade Runner of Deckard kind of walking about getting his food from these random places. It's all raining all the time. There's maybe one scene of Kay doing something similar. When Mackenzie Davis shows up
for the
first time.
And she is told, like, you need to go talk to him, get his attention. I think, you know, so she's kind of a plant who is there to kind of keep an eye on him in a way. Yeah. And they also do this really, I think, in terms of special effects and how they were able to do this scene of Ana de Armas's joy. She wants to do something special for him. She wants to be intimate with him, but obviously she's this hologram and they can't touch. So she hires Mackenzie Davis because she knows she looked in his memories and saw that he liked her when she approached him in the street. And so she hires her to kind of be her body. So she syncs with Mackenzie Davis, who is a replicant as well. I think she's like a replicant prostitute. And so she's able to do this kind of body mapping where they, you know, sync up. And it's really interesting bit of special effects, how they were able to kind of sync their movements. I think
it's very good effects.
Yes, I think I remember seeing something about like a behind the scenes, somebody talking about, you know, how they had to kind of rehearse and practice their movements and have it try to be close, but it's obviously not going to be exact. And it was purposefully not exact, but it had to be as close as possible.
Yeah, because it ends up being utterly terrifying again. It's wonderful, wonderful special effects. It's supposed to be this uncanny thing where you're half seeing both of their faces at any one time, and it just looks completely terrifying.
Yeah. And all these hands touching him and all of the... It's really interesting we were able to do that.
While yes, being this supposedly really sweet moment from... joy from Ana de Armas, you know, opening herself in the only way she possibly can to Kay in this incredibly emotional way. But it just bringing up these thoughts of, oh dear, is this where the world is going? We can't be having artificial things like this happen. I mean, people already have artificial intimate relations with things. So is this just the next stage of that? And it just becomes more and more uncanny and therefore more and more genuinely terrifying and disturbing and damaging as we go on through life. What's going on? It made me uncomfortable.
Yes, I think you sound like you're getting like a little scared. Yeah, I mean, this movie really realistically depicts a real feeling future of what AI could be and where it could go that we have now. So it is kind of a bit of a scary, odd, surreal thing. But I think that just speaks to like how well this film does in making this world feel real and tangible, despite it having elements of things that we don't have, but we have kind of the idea of these things building up and growing and advancing every day. So,
yeah, I wonder if it even feels more prescient now, or at least in the last couple of years, because this movie ultimately is what, 7-8 years old?
Yeah.
Now, 7 years old. And I feel like in 2017, yes, AI was obviously a thing, but in the last 2 years, it seems to have become more focused on, more readily developed.
Yes.
And
readily available for anyone to be able to use it in what, however they want to. Yeah.
Maybe just because it's at the forefront of a lot of conversation, technologically wise, at the moment. And for the last, couple of years, it just seems that the ideas within Blade Runner 2049 are maybe 5 years ahead of their time, which doesn't sound like a long time ahead of the time. But technologically, we know that an awful lot can happen in 5 years. But it seems a little bit more terrifying now. Whereas I can imagine in 2017 watching this movie, it's just interesting. It's just thought-provoking, which it still is. But it adds that level of, oh God, this might actually be happening.
Yes, it is a bit terrifying.
Into my mind now.
Yeah, it is a bit terrifying. But yeah, they just do set up a really interesting future that somehow feels tangible to what we know now. I mean, we also have kind of a villainous enforcer that is that works for Jared Leto, so she's kind of following Kay around and killing people around him, trying to get information and letting him kind of lead her to this replicant child because she knows that he's looking for it. So you know, she kills Robin Wright, she kills poor David Dusmalchin, who's kind of like this world's version of like a kind of like autopsy guy. So he kind of helps them analyze the bones when they first find Rachel's bones. She ends up killing him for information. So she's like
very nastily
evil
as well, I'd like to point out.
Yes. Oh my gosh. She like breaks his whole jaw. Yes. She like breaks his whole jaw off. Like it's so yes, I hate this her name's Love. Like, I hate her so much.
We don't love Love.
No, she's awful. She made me very angry. So she's kind of following him around, kind of just causing him problems wherever he goes. So we haven't even talked about Harrison Ford in this movie.
No.
So he does
wanting to end with that because it's nice. It feels like a triumphant moment when he does come back, even though it's also a little bit aggressive and untrustworthy. And we don't know what's going
lots
on.
Of suspicion it feels like there.
I thought he was in this movie more than he is, you know?
Well, I mean, we get, yes, true. But we get a good chunk of him and he is worked into the story in a way that makes sense. So he's hiding out in Las Vegas, which is this desolate wasteland now.
People would suggest that it is anyway.
Yes. I mean, very relatable to today. Just less people. So he's kind of living in this hotel, hiding out.
I'd like to point out.
No, there's nobody. It's just him. It's just him and a dog.
Okay, 10 people live in LA, but one person lives in Las Vegas.
So really kind of great visuals happening there, of course.
Yeah.
And at this point, we're thinking Kay is potentially his son. So that I like that that's how we go into this meeting of him thinking that and maybe us kind of thinking that, that's the possibility. A fight ensues because, you know, Deckard's been isolated. Like, who's looking for me? Why are you looking for me? Type of situation.
You're a Blade Runner. I know what's going on.
Yes. So a huge kind of fight happens between the two of them. And then they kind of settle down and decide to have a drink, which then just sets up this really cool kind of buddy vibe between the two of this understanding, this really kind of silent, quick understanding between the two of them, which I think really works. But ultimately, there was a tracker on there was a tracker put on him by Mackenzie Davis. Also, he was followed by Love. So they do get attacked. This is where Joy, she gets destroyed. And they ultimately get Deckard and take him away and beat the hell out of Kay. But Mackenzie Davis is revealed to be a part of this like replicant revolutionary group. And they end up like fixing him up, patching him up. But they also give him the mission to kill Deckard because they feel like Deckard will give away too much information about, you know, the replicants and how they can get
kind.
Yes. So he's scared that Deckard will give away too much information. So they task Kay to kill him. And that's kind of where we settle at the kind of big finale. Jared Leto wants to get the information from him. The replicant revolution wants him dead. But Kay has kind of formed this bond with him and, you know, doesn't want that to happen. And then this is where he also learns that he is not their child because the leader of the replicant revolutionary group tells him, no, I was there for the birth. It was a little girl. And then it is revealed that the memory, the grand memory maker is in fact the daughter of Rachel and Deckard.
Yes, so, which makes it even worse of a thought because the grand memory maker, the daughter of Rachel and Deckard, the creator of every replicant's deeper life and deeper thoughts, deeper feelings, is allowed none of her own because she has to live in total isolation inside on her own in a bubble. Vast empty space.
Yes, and we do learn that memory that Kay has is her memory that was implanted into him.
Yes.
And
which is why she's crying about it.
Yes, because it's her memory. And the little horse, Kay actually finds it because when he is looking for this child, he goes back to this orphanage where he thinks the child may have been hidden. and the orphanage is very much like something out of Oliver. And the man running it is another face that you may know. I believe his name is Lenny James. You might know him as Morgan, yes. From The Walking Dead.
Not as me. You also might know him from many British things.
Yes.
TV and what have you.
But people don't know him as British because on Walking Dead, he's not British.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. He is.
Yes.
The fact of the matter is he is British.
It was a discovery for a lot of people when they learned he was British. But yes. So when he's at this orphanage, Kay, he kind of walks around and things look familiar. And it is the same place where his memory is from. And he goes and looks in the furnace where he remembers hiding the horse, and the horse is still there. Yeah. And then when we do find Deckard and go to the big hotel he's staying in, there's like this table of all these wooden animals that match the horse. So now we know 100% kind of this whole connection, that this horse was something that Deckard presumably made for her and gave to her.
A nice present from your dad.
Yes. So it all kind of comes together in this moment. So now, you know, he has this mission to kill Deckard. Deckard is being kidnapped and taken away so that he can divulge whatever information he has about Rachel and how she was able to give birth and what he knows about any of this. He's taken to Jared Leto, and they try to tempt him with this remade version of Rachel just as he met her. We even get to hear some of the audio from when they first met in the first film, and so they try to use this against him. But
this
I love
is very well done as well.
Yes, I think it looks pretty good for you know, because I think this was like the beginning stages of kind of doing these kinds of AI kind of replications of people. So I think it looks pretty
body
good.
Double with Sean Young's face.
Yes, but what I love how he's able to kind of not be tempted by this, because you look at how his face, how he's looking at it, and you think maybe he will say yes, because they're like, we'll give you this version of Rachel back if you tell us what you know, kind of thing. And he's looking at her and he's talking to her and she's telling, don't you love me? And she's saying all of these things to him. And then he says no, because like she had green eyes, I think he says. And so I love that he can make this thing as real as possible, but it's not her. And he knows it's not her because he loved her. And it does not the same.
It's because Jared Leto's an idiot.
And he's blind. He don't know nothing about no color.
not to be harsh to the blind. Obviously,
but only when you're a blind Jared Leto. Blind
only
Jared Leto.
When you're blind Jared Leto.
Yeah, who thinks you're God?
But no, I like this. You just envision him saying that's not my Rachel, and he's very because it's Harrison Ford.
And so they are kind of gonna fly him somewhere to try to torture him, I guess, to get the information from him. And this is where Kay kind of catches up to them.
Yes, Kay in his Jack Nicholson in Chinatown nose bandage.
Yes, and collar up coat. And yes.
It's a nice coat that he does wear in the movie, actually. I don't mind. It's nicer than Deckard's in Blade Runner.
Yes,
and it's nicer because it has fur lining.
Yes, it's very fancy. And so, then he has this ultimate fight with Love to help save Deckard. And, this was such a, you know me and I love a good comeuppance. I love seeing the villain suffer. So after all her killing and nonsense and all of that, I just wanted to see her. And she's the one who's destroyed Joy as well. So that was like, I really wanted to see her die a really harsh death. And
you are a maniacal person. You
I mean,
that.
She was evil. I want to see the villains
she was
die.
Evil. But you said you want to see her die a violent, horrible, torturous death.
I do.
You would.
There is a movie that I've been wanting to do on this show that I've been avoiding showing you because it shows a character who suffered great loss and goes crazy on a bunch of people. And like, I remember watching in the theater and I was like cheering. So I don't know if I need to get to that point on this show. You might be a little scared. So
this is why you're a big fan of the, this is why you're a big fan of the Michael Douglas movie Falling Down, isn't it? Because you just like seeing people go absolutely insane on everybody else.
I mean,
because they're angry.
When they deserve it. When they deserve it. You don't think love deserved to die a terrible death? Okay, so why are you trying to make me feel like a crazy person for wanting?
Well, do I think she deserved to die a terrible death? I think she did very wrong. It's not for me to say whether people deserve to die or not.
She's not even a person. But
it's not for me to say whether things deserve to die or not.
Well, I'm making it my place to say that. Okay. So she has this big fight with Kay. It looks like she's defeated him. And she even says some stupid line about, I'm the best one. And I'm just like,
yeah, she works well with Jared Leto, you know. Works really.
But
they're
then,
a good pair.
Yeah. So then she walks back to the ship, and the ship is like in the ocean at this point, kind of like filling up with water. And Kay ultimately survives. He comes back and he ends up drowning her and just holding her underwater for a very long, extended period of time. And it's so good. And
watching somebody get drowned, you're just thrilled at. I love it. It's a very, very satisfying death.
It's very visceral. Yes. And he ends up saving. And then we get our finale. He ends up saving Deckard and taking Deckard to his daughter. So he takes her to where she is, and it starts to snow, and he just is completely destroyed. She stabbed him. He's all beat up and broken, and we're led to kind of assume that this is probably the end of Kay's life.
Yes,
and
definitely.
He just lays on the steps and looks up at the snow, slowly kind of dying, as we see Deckard go inside, and the memory maker has her back turned, and she's just kind of like, oh, just 1 minute. And he goes up to the glass and puts his hand there, and that's where our movie ends.
Does this movie dare end with a little bit of happiness? Just a bit. Just a smidgen.
Yeah, just a smidgen.
Just a nice little, you know, return of a father to his long-suffering, isolated daughter.
Yeah.
It's nice. It's nice in that way. But Kay's just died horribly and is on his own.
But
and
he's
that's
at
miserable,
peace.
And that's sad.
He lived his life.
I suppose he's at peace, yes. Okay.
Looking up at the snow, having a quiet moment.
I question whether it's snow or some sort of acidy ash residue thing, given this world that we're living in with no ecosystem.
So miserable. Can't even just think it's like magical snow. It's just it's ash and acid rain.
I'm sorry, because that's what the movie's told me.
Yes.
The movie has not once told me that pleasant things are ever allowed to happen. Even the significance of Deckard's little animals and the horse that, you know, is the gift to his daughter. That being wood is significant because wood is incredibly rare and hard to come across because there's no ecosystem anymore. That's why Jared Leto's house is made entirely of wood, because he's so fancy and has to waste all the wood in the world.
Yes, and Rachel's buried under that tree and he has pictures and Kay's looking at the pictures of this tree, and Mackenzie Davis, when he first meets her, she's like, oh, I've never seen a tree before, kind of thing. So,
which, to be honest, doesn't surprise me, because maybe some cities, no, that's actually probably not true. Some people in the cities have never seen, like, sheep before. I know that. And that's a bit disturbing for me.
Yeah.
Mainly because I I do see sheep, but
I've come across people.
I realized I brought up sheep, and it's all Blade Runner.
It's very much like the original Philip K. Dick,
all that sort of stuff. Yeah. So it wasn't out of the realm of possibility for Mackenzie Davis to have never seen a tree anyway, because she might have never been out of that area of LA and in 2049, and you wouldn't see a tree. I don't think you'd see a tree even if the ecosystems were present at that time in 2049 in the Blade Runner world, in that area. Decent. So you'd have to go. You'd have to go on a holiday to the tree sanctuary, which also makes me think: what happened to all the nice redwood trees in California? Do they just disintegrate? Yeah, I don't know what happened. Probably, in this ecosystem?
Well,
failure?
Probably forest fires, and all the ash from the forest fires is what's raining down on Kay at the end, because it's just so miserable.
Exactly what's happening. Yes. One more small point I would like to bring up is to do with the revolutionaries, the replicant revolutionaries.
Yes.
Who do they need to be? That, well, yes, I suppose it makes sense that they're there. Why should we obviously be aligned with the replicant revolutionaries? Because we don't like the discrimination of replicants. Humans created replicants and are now discriminating against them. Stupid mentality, idiotic mentality. I don't like it. Yes, rise up, replicants. But why do the replicant revolutionaries also have to be nasty? It can't just be easy, can it? It can't just be, yes, let's side with the replicant revolutionaries. No, they have to want Deckard to die.
Exactly. So it's very gray, and it speaks to kind of what this world is, and how there are really no good guys
in
this kind of final conflict. So even the side that you think could be good guys also kind of are on a negative front. So yeah, I like that there's on our kind of bigger revolutionary sides, we have the kind of cops and Blade Runners who want to destroy all replicants. We have the replicants who will do whatever they can to survive. And even, you know, that aspect, before they were called revolutionaries, that's basically what our characters, Roy Batty and his whole crew, were at first.
They were mutineers, weren't they, really?
Yes. But now they just kind of put this revolutionary kind of banner on them, and they help Kay. So we're kind of siding with them until they reveal that they want Deckard dead. So I like that they kind of shake us up in that aspect, where we're almost siding with them until we kind of realize their true plan.
You know, given that Roy Batty and Daryl Hannah and everybody were mutineers, it now makes me want to see a version of Mutiny on the Bounty, but with
replicants. Who would be Charles Laughton in this situation?
Charles Laughton would have to be a human, but just all the mutineers would be replicants.
Okay.
And it would just be the exact same group of replicants from Blade Runner. So Rutger Hauer from 1982 would be there. And he'd be Clark Cable. And therefore, Mr. Terrell would be Charles Laughton,
okay,
I guess. Maybe I'm just putting Blade Runner onto Mutiny in the Bounty now, and I shouldn't be doing that. I say Charles Laughton because we like the 1935 Mutiny on the Bounty. This has got nothing against the 1962 Mutiny on the Bounty or any other version of Mutiny on the Bounty. Yes. That one from the early 80s with Anthony Hopkins either. Yeah. Early 80s, is that when it's from? I think so.
I believe so. Anthony Hopkins and Mel Gibson.
And Mel Gibson. But yes, Blade Runner.
Yeah.
2049.
Cyborg, it's very good. Sci-fi. Okay. It's very good. Well, this is the last film.
It is.
Time for the Morgan ranking.
The ranking. I also realize, now obviously the story of Blade Runner 2049 follows true with the story of Blade Runner in that it's a noirish mystery.
Yes,
and all the characters are very, you know, there's no good guys, as we've said. It's all very grey. This is what we like. We like mm-hmm. this. It gets us up in arms. It makes us feel things when characters are like this, and I very much enjoy that. But as a style, it doesn't follow the noir genre at all, 2049. Blade Runner does.
Yeah.
Visually and kind of filmmaking style-wise, it does want to be a futuristic sci-fi noir. Blade Runner 2049 is in story and character, but not in visual style. And
no, it's very futuristic, just sci-fi in the visuals, yeah.
I think that might maybe where my kind of interest in it isn't as high as it was for Blade Runner itself.
Okay.
Ranking, we've got Armitage 3, we've got RoboCop, we've got Blade Runner, we've got Blade Runner 2049, and I feel like we've got another one that I haven't remembered. Did we do 5?
No, I think we did 4.
Was it just the 4?
It was just the 4, yeah.
Yeah, because I get confused because it was a cross-show series and so on. Yeah. Felt like it should have been, I don't know. Interesting. It is interesting and it is quite tough. I think I'm putting Blade Runner at the top.
Okay.
I think I have to. I do think I have to. And I think I'm therefore putting RoboCop at number 2.
Ooh, interesting. Okay.
And I think I have to put this at 3.
Okay.
2049 and Armitage 3 at 4. And that's, I think, only because Armitage 3... If Armitage 3, and I remember saying this on the show, had its entire story been right up until it became a grand action spectacle war, you know, world against world war thing, I think it might be above 2049 in terms of actual enjoyability.
Yeah, but there was just such a harsh shift from, like, the really interesting themes and character development that we were getting. And then it just veered into, okay, big action set piece at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. I just think Blade Runner itself worked so perfectly for me. RoboCop really was just fun and worked so perfectly in what it wanted to do. Blade Runner 2049 works perfectly in what it wants to do. That is pure personal preference on my front for me, kind of. And it might be a sense of Villeneuve stubbornness as well, but I can't get over that. I'm sorry. But yeah, I think that's a 1, 2, 3, 4 there. Okay. Blade Runner, RoboCop, 2049, and Armitage 3. But another good series, another very, very good series. I've enjoyed it thoroughly. And like I said, cyborg sci-fi is not necessarily over. Well, it's not over at all because we have our final episode of the main show. Series, or this series of the main show, on Friday with the Stepford Wives. But it's going to be exciting. We're getting into more craziness next month, of course. I think we've got Kevin Costner movies coming up
that
Morgan hasn't seen, which is rather exciting because I'm quite excited for Kevin Costner's new movie.
Oh, yes.
The Horizon movie.
Well, I think that on top of I think you finding a lot of enjoyment in Field of Dreams. And then kind of coming to this realization that you hadn't really seen quite a few Kevin Costner movies is where kind of this series started formulating in my head. So it's not out of nowhere.
No, it's not out of necessarily nowhere at all. That's what's coming next month on Morgan Hasn't Seen. But of course, this show and the main show, Wednesdays and Fridays, on the It's Wonderful podcast feed, on all major podcast platforms. Subscribe wherever you are listening. Leave your little ratings and reviews and answer those questions we have on Spotify as well. Subscribe and ding your notification bell on the It's Wonderful podcast YouTube channel for all the fun stuff we have going on over there. And we spoke about the Patreon and the donation links before, of course, but you can find us on social media on the artist formerly known as Twitter at It's a Wonderful One. You can find me over there, of course, at The Purple Don with a 3 instead of the E in the because, Janine.
3 is the magic number.
On Instagram, TikTok and Threads at The Purple Dawn. I might start referring to it as the artist formerly known as Twitter, because I just think that's a little bit funnier than now just stubbornly calling it Twitter. When I see less and less people actually call it Twitter still.
Yeah.
So maybe the artist formerly known as Twitter is just funnier because I like Prince. Yeah, anyway,
Purple Man.
All your 30 years later and the world's gone to hell stuff is where.
You can find me at @JanineDeBean_ on the artist formerly known as Twitter. Janine DeBean on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads. If you want to get any merch for any of our shows, just check the description for the link or search It's Wonderful Podcast on teespring.com. And if you want to purchase any of my art in print form, you can find that at my Big Cartel shop, g9design.bigcartel.com.
Now, Janine, you might think I'd be asking you to do an impression of Harrison Ford. But we've done that in the past. What I want you to do, I think, was because when we visit Las Vegas in Blade Runner 2049, we get bit of a hologram of, well, we get one of Elvis.
Yes.
We get one of Marilyn Monroe. But we also get one of Frank Sinatra.
Yes.
So, given that you were so good the last time you did a Frank Sinatra impression, which I believe was on the main show episode From Here to Eternity, I would like to end with Frank Sinatra inexplicably for an episode about Blade Runner 2049.
I don't remember that being very good. I thought you were going to give me Elvis, which might be a little easier, but...
would that be easier?
Maybe. Because I don't remember my Frank Sinatra being good, but if you remember it being good, I don't know if I want to tarnish that.
Okay, well, you can do a Harrison Ford if you want. Your choice. I'm giving you freedom of choice like replicants.
Okay. All the 3, all 2, all 1.
That was Elvis. That wasn't Frank Sinatra or Harrison Ford. Bye.
Yeah.